one ethical theory as well last time.
And today we're going to get in to look at something more substantial about them.
I suggest that ethical theories would have at least the following in them. We would very much like them to tell us what's good or of value, and I call that a value specification. So an ethical theory should do that. And and in addition to that, it should tell us what to do with that value.
So we would think that an ethical theory should have these two things. If you just want a moral code, you can just take the action conditions out and act in accordance with that, and that ought to do the trick. And finally, there should be some kind of justification of these things. A justification, for instance, that what's specified as good or value is indeed of good or value. The specifications to what's supposed to be done, the action condition, is the appropriate thing to do. So we require some kind of justification. This is where ethics comes in. Morality doesn't need justification in this sense. You can act morally without knowing why you act morally. You can obey a moral code. You might obey the Ten Commandments or some kind of Buddhist moral code or a Taoist moral code or some other moral code. You can obey that moral code. You can act in accordance with what the moral code says. You shall not kill or love thine... You shall not kill or covet thy neighbour's wife and so on. But not really know why you do it. You're unreflective. When we do ethics as opposed to think about morality, the question of justification comes in. So ethics differs from morality in that ethics is a reflection upon moral behaviour. Why is this moral behaviour? Is it moral behaviour? That's the difference between the two. We can say so-and-so is a moral person but knows no ethics at all. Or we could say, Forge knows a lot of ethics, but my goodness, is he immoral? You could say things like that, and they would make perfectly good sense. Now, it might seem from that obvious what the action condition should do, given the value specification. Why does one have to make this distinction between the two? I'm getting to the point where I ended last time. For instance, suppose we have this thing I call an honesty ethic. The reason there are little scare quotes like that is because these things are not fully fledged ethical theories yet, because they lack justification. They're just little examples. Surely it follows from that telling the truth is good to always tell the truth. I mean, what else could there be, you might think, apart from always tell the truth? So why does one need to make a separation here between the value, telling the truth is good, and the action, what you're supposed to do? Namely, always tell the truth. Well, I suggest that there is a difference because one could have a different ethic, and it's this honesty ethic number two, which has the same value involved, namely that telling the truth is good, but it has a different kind of action attached to it. It's suggesting that you maximize truth-telling, in brackets, even if it means lying. Now, it seems to me that, I mean, this is especially chosen to be sort of a dramatic example, where what you're doing to maximize the value is the opposite to what the value seems to say. I mean, I've chosen it especially because it's kind of a weird example. But at least it makes sense. If I can somehow maximize your truth-telling by lying to you, and if I think what's important is to make sure there's as much truth-telling going on in the world as possible, I'll lie to you. Now, this then introduces two very different sorts of ethics. This is supposed to introduce to you two very different ways of thinking about ethics called consequentialism and non-consequentialism. Again, I think I ended with this point. The basic principle of this consequentialist ethics is that it's the consequences and only the consequences of actions which are morally significant. So if my action to you is one where I lie to you, that doesn't matter. Providing that the lying I do to you brings about something which is good, i.e. maximizes, in this case, your truth-telling. It might do something else, but the action in itself and of itself, what I'm actually doing, the action I'm performing, what I'm saying here, for instance, would be one example of an action. If this has the consequence that I can make you tell more truth than you would otherwise, that's fine, there's no problem with that. The action in itself doesn't carry any moral value. What carries moral significance, moral value, etc., is the consequences of the action, what goes on later. Typically, a consequentialist will say in the action condition, maximize the value. Typically, a non-consequentialist would say, the non-consequentialist thinks that it's the act itself which is morally important. Honor the value. If you'd like to think about it this way, some people find it's useful to think about it this way. I find it useful to think about it this way. Consequentialists will typically say maximize the value, whereas the non-consequentialist, if I can put it this way, this is standard terminology. Honoring the value is perhaps not quite standard terminology. But clearly, if I'm claiming that telling the truth is good, and I'm lying through my teeth to you, there's sort of a sense in which I'm not honoring the value. I'm sort of dishonoring the value if I'm saying here, you ought to tell the truth, and I'm lying like fury about what involves telling the truth. So I don't seem to be honoring the value when I'm going about that way. So anyway, these are the two kind of very big classes of ethical theory that historically have been developed. And what I want to do today is to talk about the first of these, consequentialism, and say a little bit about those about the stuff in there. So that's a quick review of what I did last time. So I move on to consequentialism. And let me... begin by saying something general about this. The consequentialist position would be moral in that if the consequentialist is impartial about how this value is maximized. The whole idea about the ethics, another thing I said last time, was it's supposed to be, in a sense, impartial. It should be generalizable. It shouldn't just be consequences for me or my immediate family, but maybe the consequences for all of those whose happiness or whatever I can influence. So what the consequentialist would be doing would be impartially trying to maximize the value. If I'm an egoist, I could still be kind of an egoist consequentialist, and I'd be maximizing the values for me. I'd be maximizing, say, my happiness or whatever. Whereas if I'm a moral consequentialist, I'd be trying to maximize the value for all the people around the place. Okay, so now I think I'll put this overhead up, and it's a one I'll refer to quite a lot. So we'll just start off with it, if I can find it. And stick it down here. What I want to do is to say a little bit about some specific ideas about consequentialism, and then I want to offer some comments on it. So we start off with the theories of value. And the first one is called utilitarianism. That's the classical one. And one might express then the value condition for this, the value specification for this, as something like utility is good. Ha, you say. Maybe you don't. Ha, you say. But what's utility? I'm going to consider three different interpretations of this term, utility. Utility is a term, perhaps four different ones in utility. Utility is a term which has been taken over by economists, and they talk about utility in their theoretical work quite a bit. What is utility? Well, the first version that I'm going to talk about is due to Jeremy Bentham. Jeremy Bentham lived between 1748 and 1832. But in spite of that fact, I used to say good morning to him most days when I was doing my PhD at University College London, because on most days I would walk from the University College Philosophy Department to the library, and Jeremy Bentham is in a box in the hall of the main building in University College London, which is actually on the way from the Philosophy Department. You go down the back stairs, past the secretary's office, downstairs, around the corner, and there's Jeremy Bentham in a box, sort of mummified. And he doesn't say much in return, because he's been dead nearly 160 years. The reason he's in the box is the following. When he died, his body was given to science to be cut up and looked at, because he thought his body was no longer any good to him, being dead, sort of sensible kind of view, unless you're a Walt Disneyite and one of these guys. He thought his body was no longer any good to him, so he thought he would give it, so to speak, to science. Because he was a utilitarian, he was trying to help other people, and all he could do after he was dead was give them his body. And he also left directions for his sort of, to be mummified in a way and to be left sitting in the box. So what you could say of Bentham was that at least in his death, he practiced utilitarianism. He is the first main utilitarian philosopher that we take prominence to, and we have a seminar to discuss some of his views. I don't know whether we're doing that one this semester. But anyway, he wrote in his main work on utility the following. Nature hath placed mankind, this is 19th century language, it wouldn't do in the new Griffith University how to write non-sexist language, but nevertheless he wasn't able to read that. Nature hath placed mankind under the governance of two sovereign masters, pain and pleasure. It is for them alone to point out what we might do as well as determine what we will do. This is the very beginning of Bentham's main work, which is on your reading list. I forget the exact title, Principles of Political Economy, etc., etc. It's at the very beginning of that chapter, the very first chapter. He speaks of two sovereign masters. Now, this seems to imply a couple of things, but let me first say what particular version of utilitarianism this would be. And it's called hedonism, because hedonism is the view that we seek pleasure and avoid pain. Seems to me to be eminently sensible, without much reflection. This is sometimes also called psychological hedonism, because of the way Bentham made that point about us being under these two sovereign masters. It's as if our psyche, our minds, were sort of dominated by this idea. So the hedonism is not some kind of reflective or theoretical hedonism, it's sort of a psychological hedonism. Now, this doesn't mean that we don't have any choice about, in spite of the last part of that quotation, it doesn't mean to say we have no choice, because if it meant that, then this would be irrelevant to morality. What Bentham wants to conclude, though, is that what is the value that we're seeking to maximize here is pleasure, and so to speak, the value of pain is the opposite of the value of pleasure. So by maximizing pleasure, we're sort of minimizing pain. And what one would do if one is a moral hedonist is not just to try to maximize one's own pleasures and pains, but to try to maximize the pleasures and pains of, as far as we can, of other people that we're in close contact to. One of the dangers of this consequentialism is that it seems that we have to try to maximize everybody's pleasures and pain. So I have to worry about polar bears if I'm an animal liberationist, and people in Rwanda and so on. And in that case, it's just not clear how you're supposed to try to allocate your monies and so on. Singer is good on this. I'm assuming you're reading through Singer. Singer discusses these sorts of points, and I would refer you to Singer's work on this to talk about exactly what the scope of, exactly how far the scope of your consideration can go. So, I mean, that's a point to be kept in mind. I mean, do I have to worry about the pleasures of people in the Amazonian rainforest? Do I have to sort of sit there at night thinking, oh my God, what can I do about the people in the Amazonian rainforest? And the answer would be, well, not a hell of a lot. So probably it would be a bad idea to me to worry too much about that, because I'd be neglecting my cat and other really important people like that. So the point would be here that you haven't got to worry about very, very remote consequences to have a moral position to take. But if you're only interested in your own pleasures and pains, attractive as that might sound as a proposition, you're not being a moral person. So the Benthamite position is that you want to try to, these are the values, pleasure and pain. You want to try to maximize pleasures and minimize pains. So let's have a little example, which is dear to my heart. See if we can kind of put a bit of flesh on the bones of this. Suppose I'm fortunately come by it's not enough, is it, these days, $20? A $30 wine voucher. You get a decent bottle of wine for under $20 these days? Of course you can. Wine voucher to Le Court in Milton. You know that Red Bull Ponzi shop? The reason it's a wine voucher is so I can't spend it on anything else, right? From Le Court in Milton. Being a moral person, I decide what I should do with this money. Being a moral person, and there's a couple of options here. The best option is I buy a bottle of wine for myself. Now, what can you get for $30? Probably a bottle of the 1992 John Riddoch. I think you can probably get for that if you look in the right place. Not a good call, of course. Now, that's a nice bottle of wine. and I would get a great deal of pleasure from it. So I might drink that myself. Okay? That's one option I could have. Another option might be I could spend the money on a whole lot of wine casks. Now, I have absolutely no idea how much a wine cask would cost, because I haven't bought a wine cask for about 40 years. But let's suppose I can get 6 wine casks for that. And I invite my students to share a glass of wine with me, because I'm a moral person and I wish to give them pleasure, and I know that this will be ruined on them, so there's no point in giving them that. So I give these to my students. Now, if I'm really a Benthamite moralist, what I will try to do will be to see which of these courses of action maximizes the total amount of pleasure. Now, it might be that the amount of pleasure I get from this wine is so great that it kind of negates all the little pleasures that when I say my students, I don't mean you, because you're a discerning class, clearly. All the little pleasures that the people get. So, I mean, I have to try to think about these things if I'm really worried about these matters. So, I mean, this is the kind of thinking that one might go through if given this wine voucher. Now, this actually raises an interesting issue for utilitarianism, which is this. Do I, so to speak, consider... I mean, you see, this is a very big sort of... a large sort of positive value here. And if it's only me that's being considered, then, so to speak, the average utility, the average pleasure, is very high. Now, suppose I buy the 6 wine casks and give it to each of this group of undiscerning students. The average utility will be quite low. But if you add up all of the utilities, like that, if you add them all up, you might get a bigger amount than this one. So one question that utilitarians have difficulty with is this. Do you worry about the total average utility, or do you worry about the total utility? Because as a matter of fact, if you worry about the total utility, it seems to suggest that you should keep bringing in more and more people into consideration. I mean, I shouldn't just give all my students 1 glass. I should go out in the street and get an equal number of people in and give them all 1/2 a glass. Say we can manage, say, 65 glasses of wine like that. Maybe I should bring in another 65 people and have 130 on the assumption that the utility here would drop by not as much as 1/2. So maybe we should keep bringing people in. And some people have suggested that if the idea is to maximise total utility, not total average utility, this is a programme for increasing the population without limit, because the more people alive, the more people can have goods in their lives and so on. So I note this problem and I pass it by. I'd like to... One of the things that characterises being lectured to by somebody who has a background in philosophy is they don't like to lie to you, as a matter of fact. So I don't want to minimise the problems with some of these things, but I don't want to dwell on this. But this is an issue. The issue is with utilitarians... what do you maximise? Do I, as it were, stay with a bottle of John Riddick, or do I... because then, presumably, my discerning palate will get such a huge jolt of... I can't wait. A jolt of pleasure from this that I'll drink the whole thing myself. Perhaps at this point... yes, you asked me the question. I'll just put up this other thing, because there is a downside, of course, to all this business about drinking wine. So you asked the question.
I was just going to ask the question. In a way, haven't you increased pain? Because in the wine class, if you give them to your students, they're going to end up getting drunk.
You mean like this? Yeah, exactly right.
Oh, right. All right. I didn't see that, but I was thinking about
a simplistic hedonist, you see, is somebody that doesn't take account of the morning after. I think it's rather... yeah, I like the eyes on this pig, don't you? And the fact that it hasn't shaved and... fact that it's an object of moderation to more modest pigs elsewhere. So exactly right, Anne. It's just came to the right point. Anyway, that's a... let's put that up there. A moment. Light relief. So this is the first attempt to say what it is that's supposed to be maximised here. Now, the second attempt is due to John Stuart Mill, who was in fact taught by Jeremy Bentham. His dates are 1803 to 1872, roughly speaking, John Stuart Mill. His father, James Mill, was also quite influential as a philosopher, but he was not so known for developing utilitarianism Now, Mill had, whereas Bentham was by no means the first of the people that were interested in this particular line of ethics, he was the first influential one. And Mill, so to speak, could reflect upon his work. So Mill came second, and in that regard, Mill was in a position to sort of have an example to go on. He was also, as I say, taught by Bentham. His father knew Bentham quite well. So Mill had a rather different view to Bentham. Mill thought that it wasn't just hedonism that you ought to maximise, but happiness. And I'm going to read you a quotation from Mill, which refers to that in a minute. But let me, before I read that one, read another one. And it's this particular quotation. I mean, Mill is a well-known philosopher, very well-known philosopher. Nobody's fool. And this particular quotation, so to speak, justifies utilitarianism in general. And consequentialism in general. Let me read it and I'll comment on it. All action is for the sake of some end, and rules of action, it seems natural to suppose, must take their whole character and colour from the end to which they are subservient. When we engage in a pursuit, a clear and precise conception of what we are pursuing would seem to be the first thing we need instead of the last thing we look forward to. Now, it's not for nothing I was talking about rationality earlier in the course and talking about means and ends and not getting the bust of Balmain if I wanted to go to Bondi or whatever. What Mill is talking about is almost a general point about human action. He says in human action, we look to the end and then select the means. Now, it would seem then that why wouldn't this be the case in ethics? The means would be the action and the ends would be the consequences. What it looks as if Mill is saying is, well, what other alternative is there when we think about a human action except to focus on the end, to focus on your happiness or your pleasure or whatever? Surely that's the end of human action. That should be the thing we look to first, and then select the appropriate means, the appropriate actions to bring about that end. So this point of Mill's is in the very beginning, again, of his, it's general remarks, it's just on chapter 2 of the book on utilitarianism here. So it's a general point about, the reason that I mention it now and not earlier is because I want to talk about Mill now. It's a general point which justifies his particular consequentialist position. Now let me read another bit, and it will introduce to you, it's a fairly extended bit, but I think it's worth reading anyway. It's a fairly extended bit which will explain to you what the difference between his position is and Bentham's. The creed which accepts the foundation of morals, utility, or the greatest happiness principle, holds that actions are right in proportion as they tend to promote happiness, wrong as they tend to produce the reverse of happiness. So again, the action is subservient to what it produces, to the value. I mean, I can't keep saying this to you, and I think eventually you'll accept that there is a difference between what Mill's saying and what some other guy's saying. So again, the action is good in proportion to that it promotes happiness, which is the end, wrong, and it doesn't. By happiness, and this is a bit misleading, this next bit, but we'll clarify it, is intended pleasure and the absence of pain. By unhappiness, pain, the privation of pleasure. To give a clear view of the moral standard set up by the theory, much more requires to be said. In particular, what things it includes in the ideas of pain and pleasure, and to what extent this is an open question. Blah, blah, blah. Now, such a theory excites in many minds, and among them in some of the most estimable in feeling and purpose, inveterate dislike. To suppose that life has, as they express it, no higher end than pleasure, no better and nobler object of than desire and pursuit, they designate as utterly mean and grovelling. As a worthy doctrine only of swine, to whom the followers of Epicurus were, at the very early period, contemptuously likened. The subject of equally polite comparisons, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so he raises an objection to Bentham, which has been noted, that this is surely, I mean, if you're saying that the end of moral life is pleasure and pain, of Forge debating on whether to buy an expensive bottle of wine or give some wine casks to his students, if that's all there is to moral behaviour, well, that's not much, is it? I mean, that's what piggies do. I carry on. It is quite compatible with the principle of utility to recognise the fact that some kinds of pleasure are more valuable than others. It would be absurd that while in estimating all other things, quality is considered as well as quantity. The estimation of pleasures is supposed by these critics to depend upon quantity alone. Now, it is an unquestionable fact that those who are equally acquainted with and equally capable of appreciating and enjoying both do give a marked preference to the manner of existence which employs their higher faculties. Few human creatures will be content to be changed to any of the lower animals. For a promise of the fullest allowance of a beast's pleasures, no human intelligence would consent to be a fool. No instructed person, an ignoramus, no person of feeling and conscience would be selfish and base, even though they were persuaded that the fool, the dunce, the rascal is better satisfied with his lot than theirs. So what he is saying in that is that it isn't so much pleasure in itself which is relevant here to happiness, it's the quality of the pleasure. It's pleasures got by the higher faculties. And it's no coincidence that John Stuart Mill could speak Greek at the age of 3. So it's pleasures which come from the intellect that he's talking about that make us happy. So to respond to this charge that utilitarianism reduces morality down to some base piggy level, Mill replies, no, what makes people happy are things of the higher faculties, the higher intellect. Reading, doing philosophy, doing ethics, doing science, going to good movies, listening to plays, reading. Not going to wine shops and spending your money on John Riddick 92. Actually, the 90s are a lot better, I must confess, but that's $50. So this is Mill's response. It's happiness which is important, not so much pleasure. I distinguish the two, although Mill did mention pleasure in that. He meant higher pleasures, not the sort of hedonistic pleasures that are associated with Bentham. So this is a very influential position that Mill has, that it's happiness which is important. And if I'm a moral person, what I'm going to try to do is to maximise happiness, make everybody happy. And this might involve continuing to lecture on past 20 past 10. Who knows what it might involve? Moving on. Yes?
What if you don't enjoy reading? What if you're a type of person who left school, say, for example, in grade 10, because you hated studying, you hate anything that involves intellectual stimulation?
Well, I think Mill knew any of them. neither do I. That's sort of a seminar topic in a sense. I don't know if he's doing it in the group you're in or in any group, but I've sort of asked in one of the seminar topics what people think about that very point. Is Mill right about it? I mean, he's making a claim, a general claim about what makes people happy and what doesn't. And if he's wrong, then we're going to reject what he says about happiness. And in a sense, Eileen, it is Italian, isn't it? That's why I'm moving on to number 3. Because people might say, put something a bit more bland, replacing happiness with preference satisfaction. Now, that is much more bland, because I might say I prefer drinking wine to reading a book, and you might say you prefer reading a book to drinking wine, and somebody else might prefer to do absolutely nothing at all, and somebody else might prefer to buy lots of stuff. So what we're doing is moving to something ever more blander, in a sense. We start out with something really exciting, a little booze up in Milton. And we've moved through going to philosophy lectures. Now it's something really pretty bland called preference satisfaction. And the idea would then be what you want to maximise are what people prefer. If I like buying apples more than pears and that's my main obsession in life, and you're a moral person, you might help me buy apples. This is something that the economists have taken on. When they talk about utility, they tend to translate it into preference satisfaction. Because this is very much in accordance with economics, this particular view. That what the economy is trying to do is to allocate scarce resources in such a way that as many people's preferences are satisfied as possible. So preference satisfaction is a typical term for economists. And again, it's blander than happiness. I might prefer to be miserable. I mean, it's blander than that. So, again, we're moving from a fairly definite sense of what utility is. Remember, these are all particular interpretations of what it is that we're supposed to be maximising, what the value is. For Bentham, it was pleasures and pains, understood in a sort of a sensual sense. For Mill, it was pleasures and pains in a very different sense of being general happiness. For these economist types, and there are lots and lots of them, any economists will do, it will be satisfying preferences. And we have a fourth one that I'll mention here. This is the Singerian position, and I mention it because it is part of the position that Singer adopts, and that's something that I hope you've been reading. And what you ought to be looking at here is interests. And I've taken interest to be something that's separate valued from interpretations of utility. So Singer's a consequentialist, but I don't know whether he'd want to be called a utilitarian. This is just a debate about words, and don't worry about it. But I put the value as being something separate there. Now, Singer has a very kind of general understanding of interest. And essentially, it would be just something that an individual has which can be harmed or promoted. So I have an interest in my health. You all have interest in our health. You might have an interest in your family. A dog might have an interest in catching a cat, maybe. A tree might have an interest in having enough water and sunlight. Whether we can talk about dogs and cats and trees having interests is an interesting question. Singer thinks you can for dogs and cats, but he doesn't think you can for trees. If I could argue later in the course that trees have interests, then I might be able to bring trees within the sphere of moral consideration. That's just a little thing, something to stick in your minds, maybe, or not stick in your minds. But it's an interesting question as to whether we can do that at a particular point. Anyway, as it is for Singer, it's interests which are the most important. Now, here would be getting a clear conflict with this position here. Suppose I'm an alcoholic and I've got a $30 wine voucher to Le Cork here. Is it in my interest to go and buy the bottle of wine? Well, yeah, I might prefer that. That might make me happy. That might give me pleasure. But it's not in my interest to do it. Really, is it? I mean, my interest is to try not to drink, if I possibly can. So that would be a bad move. So to say we talk about interest now introduces some rather different considerations than we're in under utilitarianism. And maybe this is a better way to think about it. Maybe it is a better kind of value to have, to think about what people's interests are, rather than to think just what gives them pleasure and pain and so forth. Again, this is kind of a blander thing we've got here, more general, less easy to pin down conception. We started off with something pretty nice like booze up at Le Cork, and now we're at the position of having this concept called interest. And when I say interest, I don't mean what I'm interested in, because I might not be interested at all in not drinking. I might be really keen on drinking. So when we use the word interest, we don't mean what we're interested in the sense of being, well, what I want to turn my attention to. We don't mean interest in the bank of 10%. We mean something which is concerned with our overall good, let me say. Now, again, that's a very general sort of thing to say. Now, let me try to give a quick example of one of Singer's principles. Singer's principle of ethics is something like this. You should equally consider everybody around you's interests, but you shouldn't necessarily give them equal consideration. Here are some examples. Suppose you and I and my dog have been involved in a nasty car accident right out in the country. We have some food, we have some water, and we have some morphine. I have a broken leg, you have a broken toe, and the dog has a broken back. Now, to give equal treatment would mean something like this. Dividing up the food, dividing up the water, and dividing up the morphine, approximately in proportion to, let's say, body weight. That would be kind of equal treatment, equal consideration. That would be equal consideration and equal treatment. Something like that. It wouldn't just mean dividing the morphine into three, because a third of the morphine might actually kill the dog. So you wouldn't actually divide it into three bits, but you do it, say, by body weight. Now, if you did that, it might turn out that my broken leg was still hurting and the dog was in agony and you'd be high as a kite because you've only got a broken toe. So equal treatment would be wrong. What should be right would be we give the dog a decent amount of morphine, maybe all of it to kill it, I don't know. Maybe kill the dog, give me the rest and you can hobble on with your broken toe. But the point about that would be that you should treat people in proportion to how badly off they are with regard to their interests in this particular case. Again, if it's food, if we're out in the bush and we're lost, and I come across a stranger who's also lost, and I have some food and she doesn't. Now, what I might do there is say, oh, well, you know, we'll divide up the food 50-50. But if she's weak and starving, I should give her more of my food than I keep myself. So we would consider everybody's interests equally. We wouldn't necessarily treat them equally. It would depend upon the circumstances in which they're in. Now, I might be desperately trying to consider the interests of the Amazonian rainforest people, but there's not a lot I can do about it. So maybe being a moral person, it would be enough for me just to be aware of those sorts of problems. to be aware that there are people in the Amazonian rainforest that are in strike because McDonald's are building hamburger stands on the Orinoco or something like that. I can't do anything about it, but at least I can think about it. Maybe that's enough. But these are difficult problems. You know, it's not clear how far you have to consider. But Singer's point, I think, is very useful. Equal consideration, but not necessarily equal treatment. It wouldn't be a good idea to give a dog, to give all of us a third of the morphine. Let me just note that point there. We've gone through that a little bit here. It's with regard to the theory of action of consequentialism. They're both maximizing principles, but the question is they're maximizing different things. What Singer's trying to do, in a sense, with his equal consideration, not necessarily equal treatment, is he's trying to, well, in the case I've given, probably the two things would come out the same. He's trying to maximize average utility. There seems to be a sort of a presumption in favor of that. I mean, if I'm a heroin addict, at the same time as having a broken leg, I mean, we might be actually, my total utility might be vastly increased by giving me all the morphine. But that wouldn't be the right sort of thing to do in that particular case. So I think we would want to maximize average utility. Again, I don't want you to worry too much about the theories of action there. But I do want to note that that the theory of action for consequentialism isn't just maximize it. You might have to think a little bit about how you go about that. Now, we won't do that because you won't want me to go through that, but I'll leave it up there just for fun. Now, I want to conclude this lecture. We've got 10 minutes. And if you'd like to sort of take part in the conclusion, you can. I think that consequentialism in general is a very seductive general theory of ethics. We had the quote from Mill before about, surely you choose the end first, then you select the means. I mean, what else can there be except the fact that we have certain sorts of consequences that we want to maximize? The trouble with utilitarianism is that it seems to be prey to some horrible counterexamples. And I'll read you three, and then we might talk about them and decide what's going on. I think that in any moral code, particularly when it's concerned with science, we have to have an element of consequentialism in it. But if that was all there was to it, we wouldn't have to worry about what I'm going to talk about on Monday, which is essentially rights theory. So we wouldn't have to worry about that if we could be happy with consequentialism. So I want to just conclude this lecture by offering some criticism of consequentialism. I don't, as I say, this will be criticism, but I don't think it'll be sufficient to make us get rid of consequentialism altogether. Here's the first example. So-and-so tells the story of a southern sheriff who must frame an innocent black man in order to head off a race riot led by the Ku Klux Klan, in which many lives would be lost. Let's weigh up the consequences. One black life against many other lives, some black, some white. According to consequentialism, it seems that the sheriff ought to frame the innocent black man. That's the first example. Second example. I am shipwrecked on a desert island with Alison. This sounds rather good. It's not my example. It's Charles Pigdom's. I am shipwrecked on a desert island with Alison. She dies, but first extracts a promise. I must ensure her large fortune goes to her worthless lover, Wayne. I don't think Charles liked the name Wayne for some reason. I return to civilization, where it becomes clear that utility will be better served if I gave the money to a woman's refuge. Utilitarian dictates I give the money to the refuge, etc. So the point again would be, another example I used to use was the mountaineering one, where you fall down the mountain with your best friend and he's about to die and says, I want to leave all my money to my alcoholic Uncle Wayne. You know that if you leave it to alcoholic Uncle Wayne, he'll fritter it away on John Riddick and die soon. On the other hand, if you give it to a home for reformed alcoholics, you'll do better. In both cases, the amount of utility that you do by not keeping your promise will be greater than the utility you would provide if you did keep your promise. The happiness that you would give will be much greater if you broke your promise than if you kept your promise. That's the second example. Here's the third example. Dr. Georgina is a geneticist with two infant children to support. Her health compels her to live in the country. There is only one country job available. It is in biological warfare. Her old professor, Chloe, tells Georgina that she knows she's not keen on germ warfare, but if she doesn't take up the job, it'll go to the gung-ho Dr. Sophie X, and the vile work will proceed at a greater pace. So, if Georgina does not take the job, her two infant children will not do well at school, she might have to live in the city, and moreover, the work will go at a greater pace because of the gung-ho Dr. Chloe. That's quite hard to say. The gung-ho Dr. Chloe. If she does take the job, on the other hand, it will compromise her integrity because she does not believe in germ warfare. Now, I don't know whether you want to comment on any of those cases, what you think. The first one's about the framing the black man. The second one is about the promising Alison. And the third one is about the integrity of Dr. Georgina. I think that all of those three cases tell against consequentialism. And why do I say that? Well, before thinking about ethics at all, pre-thinking about ethics, just thinking about my, moral intuitions, it seems to me that in all of those three cases, it would have been wrong, A, to frame the black man, it would have been wrong, B, to break your promise to Alison, and it would have been wrong, C, for Dr. Georgina to take the job. Even though, if we look at the consequences of each of those three cases, they would be better if the other course of action had happened. So it seems that it would have been better, as far as the consequences are concerned, if one black man was framed rather than 20 other folk were killed in the race riot. In spite of that, it seems to me that it would be simply wrong for the black man to be framed by the white sheriff. And I can then, having done some ethics, say why I think it's wrong. And it tells against justice. That's what this one tells against. The case of the black man tells against the principle of justice. And justice calls for, in essentially, fair distribution, a fair go. That's what justice is about. Equal treatment is what justice is about, a fair go. If you've done something wrong, justice might punish you, maybe. But if you've done nothing wrong, to convict somebody and cause them pain and suffering because they've done nothing wrong goes against justice. And what the example is posing is when one particular moral thing, and again I'm not saying what ethical theory this comes from, it's just sort of a pre-ethical moral principle of justice, tells against consequences. And in my opinion, justice wins. I mean, maybe you don't agree with me, maybe you think that the right, morally right thing to do was for the black man to be framed. Maybe you think that. That's certainly the expedient thing to do. That's certainly the easy way out, in a sense. But is it the moral thing to do? I suggest it isn't. I suggest that you just have to bear the consequences of having the race riot. That's what I think. I think if the sheriff's a moral person, he'll sit there and tough it out. Because to frame the black man is to tell against justice, and that would not do. Now, you may not agree with that. In the second case, keeping your promises, there seems to be it's harder to say whether exactly what kind of moral principle keeping a promise is. In the case I used to do, it was my best friend was dying on the mountainside, and he'd said to me, "John, I'm dying, I'm going, I'm slipping fast. Please, the last thing you ever do, I want to leave the money to worthless Wayne. I know I shouldn't, but he's my uncle." Now, I mean, am I going to say, okay, yes, of course, old chap, bad luck, chin up, and then go and give the money to an alcoholic's home? I mean, I don't know, I just think that would be wrong to do that. I've promised my dying best friend, and I've broken a promise. And it seems to me there's a strong presumption in keeping promises. I mean, if we always broke promises, I mean, no one would get anywhere, would they? So it seems to me, again, the case of promising. It seems to me that's a strong sort of moral intuition that we have. Promising. Which, again, the consequences of keeping your promises can be bad. Old Wayne, I'll be at his funeral in a couple of weeks later, died from an overdose of John Riddick. In fact, he died because a whole case fell on him when he was drunk. So the consequences of me keeping my promise might be bad. But again, it seems to me that I can't swallow that one. And the last one about Dr. Georgina. tells against integrity. Another morally relevant thing, to talk about somebody's integrity means that they act in accordance with their beliefs. If you have certain beliefs and you act in accordance with them, then, so to speak, your integrity is intact. Now, this normally might not be a problem, but when there's some kind of nasty conflict, there might be a problem. Everybody else might be doing one thing, you don't agree with it. Everybody else might want to go to a non-vegetarian restaurant, but you're a vegetarian, your beliefs are you shouldn't eat animals. You insist that either you don't go, or you'll go to a vegetarian restaurant. This might make you unpopular. Your friends might say, oh, come on, couldn't you just have vegetables? And you could say, no, no, I object to the practice of eating animals, and I won't be party to any group who eats animals. So you insist on your integrity. The case of Dr. Georgina is stronger than that. She has to weigh the consequences of her not acting in accordance with her integrity. And they're kind of nasty. They affect her children. And moreover, the work will go on anyway. But again, it seems to me that this is a very strong appeal in all of these cases. And so what I'm saying about consequentialism is it seems at first sight to be the way to go with regard to ethics. But it can't be the only way to go because there are these problems with it. There are other things that are morally relevant which can come into conflict with consequentialism. And that is why I think that we have to consider some alternative ways of thinking about what's valuable and what's the right kind of action. That's why we can't just be content with consequentialism. That's my view. Now, you might not agree with that. You might think that you might be consequentialist through and through. I mean, Peter Singer is. He doesn't seem to worry too much about these sorts of things. The person that wrote these notes, this is a handbook of notes from an ethicist at Otago called Charles Pigden. He's very much against consequentialism. I mean, he thinks it's just a disaster. And he thinks it's a horrible beast that won't lay down. He's always bashing it. It keeps getting up again. So he's dead against it. So the reason why this is interesting is because there's a matter for debate here. There aren't any complete and final answers. But what you people might be wanting to do in this course, if you want to try to find some answers which are definite, you might think, well, I can swallow this sort of thing. Okay, it's tough. But it's the consequences that count. So, I mean, you might want to try to think about, I mean, you don't have to come out of this course with a moral code, obviously, but you might start thinking about these sorts of matters and see what you think about consequentialism. And then in the next lecture, I'll consider some non-consequentialist aspects of ethics. And these are less, maybe a little bit even less intuitive than the consequentialist. I mean, maximize happiness has kind of got a homely ring about it. Respect the rights of animals is a less sort of homely, I guess. Thank you.